The following Dharma talk was given by Danika Shoang Ankele Osho at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoang Osho is a Dharma holder and priest in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, everybody. And good afternoon, everyone who is joining from a distance. I want to start with a passage from the biography of Tenzin Palmo, Cave in the Snow, written by Vicky McKenzie. For those who may not be familiar with her, Jetsunma Tenzin Palmo is a nun and teacher in the Kagyu Vajrayana school of Buddhism. And she's an inspiring figure. She's been practicing for decades. She's now in her early 80s. And she was the second Western woman to ordain in that lineage, and she ordained in 1964, so she's been a nun for a long time. And she's been a champion of women and other nuns in the Tibetan school of Buddhism, and has founded a nunnery. And she's often held up because she spent 12 years in retreat in a cave in the mountains of Nepal. And not many of us do that with our life. So people are impressed. So this is just an anecdote from this book, Cave in the Snow, where Tenzin Palmo is talking. This is before the cave. And she is. She has traveled to India and is meeting with various teachers and studying various places, and as you might imagine, is often the only woman and the only Westerner and the only Western woman wherever she goes. And she encounters some difficult times, and one of the highlights during one of these darker, sort of heavier times early on was meeting the Togdens. And so these are they're ordained monks who have been sort of, have shown exceptional promise in their practice. And so they have been taken apart from the rest of the congregation to be trained in really particular ways. So even as children, I think they're selected, they're seen for the purity of their intent, and they undergo this very rigorous training and secret teachings, and in the sort of the annals of the tradition, their mystic feats are legendary. This is where like the flying comes in and being able to dematerialize. she describes them as looking like Eastern Rastafarians. So they have they don't cut their hair. They have these really long, ropey dreadlocks and wear these kind of robes. She describes them as white, scruffy white skirts. So they cut kind of an impressive figure. And so Tenzin Palmo is living in a house with the Togdens, and she loves it. And she practices with them some, and they do the practice of tummo, where they sit in the cold with a wet sheet and practice generating heat with their body to dry the sheet and this kind of thing. So she's very impressed. And this is Tenzin Palmo speaking. They told me that in Tibet, when they were chosen to be Tugdens and taken up to the caves, they were so excited because they felt that now they were going to become yogis. But for the first 3 years, they were instructed to do nothing but watch their mind and practice bodhicitta, the altruistic mind. They did that and nothing else for 3 years. They said it was in those 3 years that their minds transformed. After that, all the many practices they did were just building upon that foundation. One time, one of them said to me, "You think we yogis are doing some very high, fantastic, esoteric practice, and if only you had the teachings, you could also really take off. Let me tell you, however, that there is nothing I am doing that you have not been taught. The only difference is that I am actually doing it, and you are not." Actually doing the practice. Yeah. So, right from the very first time we walked in this monastery, we received all that we need to know. The way to work with your mind is to see what arises, see the thought we say, let it go, and come back to the breath. Come back to your practice. And when I was trained to offer beginning instruction, the person who trained me said, "You should repeat that phrase several times, because usually people are in somewhat of a haze during beginning instruction, and you want them to at least get that much. So if you repeat it several times, see the thought, let it go, come back to the breath, then when they land on their cushion, maybe they have a chance, you know, of actually engaging the practice, because that part might have sunk in." So, what is this practice? When we're not practicing, we're not seeing the thought. The thoughts are coming, we can be sure of that, but we're not recognizing that that's what's happening. They're just coming, we're acting, we're reacting, we're in our usual mode, you might say. Or sometimes we do see the thought, but we don't let it go. We see the thought and then we grab hold and we continue down that same track. Or sometimes we see the thought and we let it go, but we don't really come back to our practice. We drift off somewhere else, that thought kind of reminds us of something else, and we're off thinking about that. And so this kind of lean instruction is actually hard, difficult, challenging to genuinely implement, and certainly to genuinely implement moment after moment after moment. We can do an approximation of this practice with some ease, and we can get close enough, and we can still like see the fruits of it. Things will still happen for us. But that real like full engagement, I feel like that's what that anecdote with the Tugden makes me think of. Like, I am actually doing the practice, and you are not, the Tugden says. And so what's happening when we are engaging the practice? When we are seeing the thought, what is that? That's our awareness. When we are letting go of the thought, what is that? In a sense, that's also just our awareness, bright and clear. Rather than pursuing, we hold. And the coming back, what are we coming back to? That's really just our awareness also. So the practice is just being aware. Rather than caught up in our patterns and our projections and our reactions and our stories, just aware. And throughout the whole of our life of training and practice, we will be developing and refining this art. In a sense, that beginning instruction is offered provisionally, as though there's a self, as though there are thoughts, as though we could let them go, as though we've gone somewhere, as though we're coming back. It's offered provisionally and generously to get us started. Along the way, we see there's no one to see it. There's nothing to let go of. There's nowhere to come back to. Just awareness. There are some lines from Genjo Koan that Shugen Roshi spoke about a few weeks ago that I wanted to bring in as part of this. To carry the self forward and realize the 10,000 dharmas is delusion. That the 10,000 dharmas advance and realize the self is enlightenment. Can we consider these lines from Dogen Zenji as pith instructions for Zazen? How does this teaching connect to see the thought, let it go, come back. Come back to your practice. To carry the self forward. To carry the self forward and realize the 10,000 dharmas is delusion. To carry the self forward, that says it right there. We're constantly reinventing and reinvesting in this self. And as Roshi said the other day, it's just a sense of something. To carry the self forward, this arises with each thought that we have of ourself and with each thought that we have of other, of not self. And it's not a problem, except that we are fooled. And Roshi talked also about that study of the self from further down in Genjo Koan. To study the self, to see what we're doing, to see and witness the creation, we can see for ourselves how carrying the self forward is delusion. And so if we have a notion of an enlightenment journey in which the self, I, is going to realize something, reality, it, other, then pretty much for sure we're going to get entangled. And so what's the remedy? What's the medicine? That the 10,000 dharmas advance and realize the self is enlightenment. So So in the midst of zazen, we can be churning away and cranking away in our thought world, having lost touch with seeing the thoughts and letting them go some minutes or so ago. And then recognizing that, letting the 10,000 dharmas advance, the sound of the rain comes in, the sensations in your body, that funny feeling you've been carrying around. You make space, you allow them to come. Right in there, is where our practice is alive. When Roshi said yesterday that being okay with not being okay is not mediocrity, I felt like you were speaking just to me. We're not advancing the self. We're not trying to fix or make better or improve the self. We're okay. We're okay. And what happens as we learn and sharpen our capacity to be right there? Worlds open up. When we don't practice like this, then we're back in our habit, back in our collection of patterns. Tarthang Tolku writes, "From an ultimate perspective, there is only pure awareness. Awareness itself does not have any obscuration, so it accepts all patterns, all experiences. As soon as experiences filter through the senses and perceptual patterns begin to accumulate, then all the images, memories, and reflections form what we call consciousness. This is not to say that a substantial, original, or specific consciousness comes into being. We think that there is a consciousness, but it is merely a collection of patterns which have accumulated like dust. This accumulation is what we call the self. If we could sweep away all these patterns so that the room of the mind were empty, we would not be able to find any consciousness at all. At the end of consciousness, consciousness itself no longer functions. It is transcended. Only awareness remains." Awareness is one of those words. Tricky, pointing to something, but also not what we think. A provisional teaching. And nothing sort of precipitates that activity of mind, that spinning, those patterns, that accumulation of dust, more effectively than when we don't know. We're so uncomfortable with not knowing. We'll latch on, we'll grab, we'll invent, we'll fill in to keep that not knowing at bay. If you look at where your suffering is emerging, at where your stress is emerging, see, like, is there an element of actually not knowing that you're filling in? I don't know, not 100% of the time, but like a lot. We fill in people's intentions and meanings and motives all the time and suffer from it when we really don't know. And we will create all kinds of bizarre scenarios that are really not grounded in reality because they're familiar to us, because that's our pattern, because that's our way of looking at the world. And so if we have wounds from the past, we bring them forward, looking through the world through our wounded glasses. We're sure to suffer. I had a recent experience of really kind of both watching my mind take a massive spin around bizarreness and like getting drawn in and having to like draw myself back from it pretty recently. Not long ago, the beginning of September, I returned from a retreat in Colorado with Sokni Rinpoche. And I got back on a Wednesday night, just around the time Zazen was ending, and saw Gokhan in the cabin and went to bed, and I was tired. And so in the morning, I let myself sleep in a little extra. And Gokhan was already out of the cabin when my alarm went off. And I woke up and the bed was wet. Up behind where my head was definitely damp. And then as I was kind of coming to it, it smelled like pickles. And I like woke up a little bit more and I felt around and there was like a big something up behind me in my bed. And I looked and there was a half gallon mason jar of bread and butter pickles in my bed that had opened somewhat enough to have leaked out, and now half of the bed was covered with pickle juice. I'm like, wait, what? And so the next several minutes as I was like getting up and getting ready for Zazen, I was like, what the hell? Like, why would Gokhan put pickles under my pillow in bed? And so I'm like going through some scenarios quite rapidly. Like, was it a gift? Was it a surprise? I'm like, it's so weird. I mean, I didn't establish the context for those of you who are not in residency. Gokhan is like the pickle guy. He's been growing cucumbers in the orchard and having people pickle them. Maybe some of you have been among the picklers. And so there are jars and jars of pickles, and often during Hosan we'll bring up some pickles and have them. So then I start thinking, well, was he storing them in the bed? Like, while I was gone, like, and I couldn't figure out like why the bed would be a good place to store the pickles. I'm thinking like, okay, like why? Like, why are they in the bed? Why are they in the bed? It's not cool in the bed. If it were cool in the bed, like maybe it would be like a refrigerating zone. And so I'm trying to like understand. And then I start getting dark. And I'm not gonna tell you how dark I got, but I will tell you this, that it started to pivot around the word pickle, and like the pickle, like you could send that as a message, like I'm in a pickle. Yeah, I'm like, this is like so unlike Gokhan. He would not send me like a coded message with like a jar of pickles, but I'm trying to understand how the pickles came to be in the bed. So in that experience, at some point, I realized, like, this is fruitless. Please stop. Please stop. And later this morning, when silence is lifted, I'm sure there is, like, some kind of explanation for how the pickles got to be there. And sure enough, there was. And I never would have guessed it. It was a practical joke on Gokhan by one of the cooks, having to do with pickles. And I'll just leave it there for now. And if you're really interested, you can ask Miro about it after Sishin. Anyway, all this by way of saying, like, even though nothing was matching up, and Gokhan didn't know about that jar of pickles, by the way. There were two jars of pickles. One of them he found, and he never thought that there would be a second jar of pickles. So hence it stayed undiscovered until I was there. But if we're left to our own devices, we start to get crazy. Yep. And so, when you are suffering, look to see, are you filling in? And are you willing to practice being in not knowing instead of filling in? To carry that the 10,000 dharmas advance and realize the self is enlightenment. That the 10,000 dharmas advance and realize the self. As the mind quiets, we can relax into a more receptive state. Not doing, not creating, not spinning, but experiencing. In Bendoa, The Endeavor of the Way by Dogen Zenji, he writes, all Buddha Tathagatas who individually transmit inconceivable dharma, actualizing unsurpassable complete enlightenment, have a wondrous art, supreme and unconditioned. Receptive samadhi is its mark. Only Buddhas transmit it to Buddhas without veering off. Sitting upright, practicing Zen is the authentic gate to free yourself in the unconfined realm of this samadhi. The wondrous art, supreme and unconditioned, receptive samadhi is its mark. Receptivity. In other translations of Bendoa, that is translated as self-fulfilling samadhi. And I actually noticed in an earlier translation that Kaz Ta-Nehisi did, he uses the phrase self-fulfilling in Moon in a Dewdrop. And when Bendoa appears in that volume, he uses self-fulfilling samadhi is its mark. And then in Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, which came later, that same essay is revised, at least that term. And I reached out to Kaz to ask him and why he changed it. And he said that the characters that are Jijuyu Zanmai, which he's translating as receptive samadhi, are self, receive, use, and samadhi. And he says talking about a one-pointed body and mind state of meditation. The self is receiving and being active in samadhi. And he said self-fulfilling is an accurate translation, but he found it problematic because it sounds selfish. Self is misleading, he said. And so he revised it to receptive samadhi. Really, really cool. We learn that actually what letting go means, seeing the thought letting go means not grasping. That's really the key practice. If we're actually going to take up the practice, it's not grasping. so that we see the activity of the mind and we just don't grasp. And so how is it that we can not grasp and yet like stay aware and concentrated? How is it that we can shift from a mind that is conditioned and patterned to carry the self forward into being receptive and allowing the 10,000 dharmas to advance? Well, that is our natural mind. In a sense, all this effort is to find our way to our natural mind. So how is it that we can concentrate in that sense of samadhi, that stable attention and awareness, and not grasp, and allow the natural clarity, the natural light of our mind to ripen or blossom or unfurl or reveal itself or be? We have to find our own way. But I did want to offer the possibility of devotion as part of that. The mind and heart of devotion, which can really open up our connection in a way that sort of circumnavigates the tangling conceptual mind. It brings it more into the feeling realm, more into the subtlety of our body, that kind of presence. If you just think about the word devotion and what it alludes to, you know, devotion, if we're devoted to something, we're attentive, we're sincere, we're taking care, we're wholehearted, we're receptive, devoted. It's hard to talk about the mind of devotion, the heart of devotion. It's really a thing that we have to feel. It's an energy, maybe it's an attitude, you could say. And this retreat that I mentioned going to, that was a really big part of the teaching. So Sokni Rinpoche is a teacher in the Vajrayana, and I really appreciated the opportunity to go. It was really beneficial to me, and I hope that I can share that benefit with the Sangha. And in that tradition and in his teachings, devotion is really cultivated explicitly through various practices because of its power to help us nurture an open, compassionate, receptive state of mind and heart. And, you know, coming back from that retreat and being kind of steeped in some of those teachings on devotion, I really felt like how devotion is so present. It just has a different form in Zen. It's so present. Like every service that we do, like all those prostrations, like all like the chanting of the four vows, like the meal gatha, Orioki is just like a devotion fest. All the liturgy is like a container for devotion. And then I remember years ago saying to Roshi that I felt so devoted. I felt this sense of devotion. And he asked me, devotion to what? Which was such a great question to practice with and feel into. I mean, I feel like I see devotion everywhere in the Sangha, right? And devotion to the three treasures, to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, devotion to the ancestors in our services, devotion to the monastery. So many people who come and like give their time and energy to the Sangha, to the monastery, to the temple, all with this energy of devotion. Devotion just to practice. I think of our Shuso who traveled all the way from the other side of the world to be here and lead the Ango. Like that's like very devoted. The whole of the Shobogenzo, Dogen's Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, is like one big unfurling, like devotional song. All the work, straightening the zendo, cooking the meals, so much devotion. And so to recognize, like, there's a quality of devotion that can cut through our mental tangles. That heart quality, it's really good to bring it forward when you're snagged or stuck, when you're feeling judgy. You know, if you're judging someone, maybe to take a moment and just recognize like their manifestation of devotion to the Dharma. You will find it every time. Can you let that soften? Can you appreciate? Devotion can help us gather our scattered mind. A really devoted mind and heart is unified in its devotion. Devoted to the breath, devoted to Mu. Completely devoted. But words will never reach it. So on the last morning of this retreat, was, I think, the most powerful teaching for me, anyway, of the week. And it came, it was a teaching on removing obstacles and enhancing the path. And Sokni Rinpoche was trying to teach about devotion. And he was talking about Guru Yoga, which I know some of you are familiar with, essentially a practice of devotion where you're kind of summoning forth and calling out to the Guru for supplicating the Guru for blessings. And he was trying to teach about what was happening with this practice. And what was really interesting to me about it, so he has a fairly good command of English, and so will often teach for a stretch in English here and there. And then it's like when he gets into something that's more, you know, beyond his ability to communicate with fluency in English, he'll speak in Tibetan, and he has this wonderful translator who's also been his student for, I think, a couple decades. And so this teaching that he was giving on Guru Yoga, he kind of started it with like this kind of like you could feel him being like, okay, like how am I going to say it? How am I going to express it? Like, oof, this is hard. And he went into Tibetan and he was talking in Tibetan, and then the translator paused. And you could see, this was unusual to see the translator also pause and like really think. And I was like, huh, okay. And then the translator started to speak and gave it a shot to say what he was communicating. I have it in my notes. I have my note version of what it was. Yeah, so he had started by talking about how Oh my God, I looked at the time. It's okay. Let's see. Let me just like see. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. All right. Just steady on here. So he talked about faith and how faith has this kind of cognitive aspect to it. Like faith is like the like how we're like, huh, like this is really true, or somehow taking this as my path makes sense. Faith is like, oh yes, this seems to be working. And then he was trying to say that this is not the open door to the swift path. More is needed, more than faith. And so mugo, devotion. And so the translator was talking about how the inner conditions are that the saw, the expressive potential that comes from realizing the underlying nature of things, from realizing emptiness, this part of us, plus the blessings from the phenomenal level, so the relative world. And so he was kind of talking like that, and it petered out, and I can feel it in my notes. It's like, wait, what? And then Sogni Rinpoche said, okay, try again. And so the translator again went, and he started to talk about how there's this expressive energy that's coming from inside, and it has to meet with this potential coming outside. And again, he was talking in this way, and Rinpoche said, ah, try again. And so that now Rinpoche starts talking in Tibetan as though he's going to just like say it again in a different way. But instead, he starts to pantomime. And he actually ends up delivering this teaching on like inner conditions and outer conditions and devotion thoroughly through pantomime. And so he's doing things like, oh, yeah, da, 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 da. Oh, phew, phew, phew. Oh, 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 like this. And it was so exhilarating. I'm, you know, how could I do it justice? But it was like entering into that sphere of like words will not reach it. And his energy of just trying to show the feeling state of it communicated so much more. And at the end, he sort of like finished with his pantomime, and there was just like a big like kind of joyful laugh from the assembly as it felt like the teaching had finally landed. And he was like, pretty good, huh? The inner and the outer condition. And he was careful to say that the inner and outer, he said, it's not really two, but we'll leave it like that for now. And I then found this passage from Shinjin Gakudo by Dogen, Body and Mind Study of the Way. At the very moment when the aspiration for enlightenment is aroused, the entire world of phenomenon arouses the aspiration for enlightenment. Although the aspiration for enlightenment seems to create conditions, it actually does not encounter conditions. The aspiration for enlightenment and conditions together hold out a single hand. A single hand held out freely. A single hand held out in the midst of all beings. It seemed so evocative to me. That aspiration for enlightenment, at the very moment when it's aroused, the entire world of phenomena also arouses the aspiration for enlightenment. A single hand. As he was winding down that teaching, Sogni Rinpoche said, in Dzogchen, things as they are is the ultimate guru. the ultimate guru is things as they are. What does that look like, that ultimate guru? I was thinking of Hojin Sensei's art show. The study of one thing, just as it is, manifesting again, and now like this, and like that. What is that guru teaching? Receptive samadhi, what does that look like? The 10,000 things advancing to realize the self. There was one section of the exhibit, painting after painting of this green glass goblet. Riveting. That the 10,000 dharmas advance and realize the self is enlightenment. At the start of my time in Crestone, I had the opportunity to have a private interview with a Kenpo who was at the retreat center, a Tibetan teacher. And I was so grateful that conditions worked out, that I had that chance to speak with him. And I asked him a question about deity practice, this kind of practice, and you know, with the empty nature of things, how does that work? I don't remember exactly how I phrased the question, but along that. And he said, yeah, well, he said, you know, deity practice is so that you can realize that this is the deity. And he pointed to the gong sitting next to him. And this is the deity. And he pointed to the lamp. And this is the deity. And he pointed to the table. Concentrate your mind, my friends. Watch. See what arises. Don't do anything. Just be awake. Stay in the room. Stay in your body. Be devoted as though your life depends upon it.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.